This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century American History Guy. A little more than 400 years ago, a few dozen Englishmen and boys set up camp near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. Ever since then, we Americans have been quarreling about who is and who's not welcome on these shores.
Each week on Backstory, we pluck a topic from the news and try to fill in some of its historical context. This week, our topic is aliens in America. How have we regarded newcomers over the years? Who gets to stay and who has to go? We're a nation of immigrants, so how do we draw the line between us and them?
It was only last year that Washington lawmakers were debating some of the finer points of all this. You remember all that talk about immigration reform, of figuring out some way that immigrant workers could get their papers? There seemed to be a consensus emerging then that something had to be done. After all, the number of undocumented immigrants has almost tripled over the past 15 years. But in the end, partisans on both sides killed the reform proposal, and in the place of tough questions, only tough talk remains.
Turning now to our nation's border crisis, an outrageous new proposal could make it even easier for illegal aliens to live and work in this country. Indiana
state lawmakers. I'll treat you like a human being, and I'll treat you with dignity. But if you break into my country, you know what? I'm going to take your DNA, and I'm going to put you on a plane, and I'm going to send you the hell back to your frickin' country.
We're getting refugees now who have never used a telephone, a toothbrush, or toilet paper. You're telling me they're going to assimilate? They will never assimilate. They come here and they bring their destitute ways to this country and they never assimilate. And then their children become gangbangers. It is a disaster.
How is it possible that foreign turbulence imported by shiploads, that riot and ignorance and hundreds of thousands of priest-controlled machines should suddenly be thrown into our society and not produce here turbulence and excess? Can one throw mud into pure water and not disturb its clearness?
Well, those were media giants. Lou Dobbs, Glenn Beck, Michael Savage, and the biggest one of them all, Samuel Morse. Yep, that's right, Samuel Morse, famous for inventing the telegraph. What you didn't know is that Samuel Morse ran unsuccessfully for mayor of New York on an anti-immigration platform in 1836.
And this just shows you that the anti-immigrant or nativist sentiment we hear these days is certainly not a new one. Only the immigrants have changed. True, it's a far cry from that famous inscription under Lady Liberty, "Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." But there's a funny thing about even that poem. Its welcoming message was penned at the very same time that federal immigration restrictions were beginning to take shape. It was the 1880s, and for the first time, whole classes of people were being excluded. Mentally retarded people, paupers, polygamists, persons convicted of crimes involving moral turpitude, and the Chinese. Up until that point, there hadn't been a problem with illegal immigrants, per se.
The thing about illegal immigration is that it only happens when you have laws restricting immigration. When there are no barriers, everybody's legal.
That's Mae Nye. She's an historian at Columbia University who studies immigration. When I spoke with her, she explained that although nativism has been around for a long time and the Chinese were barred early on, it wasn't until the 1920s that Congress started imposing quotas on immigrants from other Asian and European countries.
You can divide American history in this sense into two periods. You had a period of open immigration where borders were normatively open, and then there were exceptions to that rule. The most famous or infamous was Chinese exclusion. But since the 20s, we've had a system that is normatively restrictive, and getting in is the exception, not the rule.
There's a strong theme of nativism throughout 19th century American history. Why is it under those circumstances that more effort wasn't made to regulate immigration?
Well, the nativists carried on a battle that took 30 years to get what they wanted. And I think the reason why it took them so long was because there was a great need for immigration. The late 19th century is a time when there's an incredible expansion of American industry. It's a time of building cities.
Right.
And when we talk about nativism in the American population, it's certainly true that this was a very strong current, but it was never hegemonic. There was always a diversity of opinion about immigration. So there were certain elites who were opposed to people coming in who were unskilled and uneducated. And there were also American working men, native-born whites, who themselves came from immigrant backgrounds, but nevertheless thought there was competition from immigrant labor. So you had different kinds of interests or reasons why there was opposition to immigration. But you also had many people who thought immigration was a good thing.
Yeah. Well, what caused that to switch then?
I would say World War I and its aftermath. After the war, there's a combination of nativism with anti-radicalism, you know, an association of immigrants with Bolshevism on the one hand, anarchism, you know, on the other. So all these things combined finally to convince Congress to pass restrictions on immigration. And in 1924 really is when a permanent system was set into place.
So ideology was the added element that led to this toxic mix that resulted in a high protective wall against immigrants.
I think that's correct. And economically, by the 1920s, there was less need for huge inputs of unskilled labor. By the 20s, you know, you have an industrial system that now is much more mature, and increases in productivity now come from things like industrial discipline, for example, right, and technological improvements. But I would also say that there's an international context that we should keep in mind. World War I pretty much consolidates an international system where nationalism, high borders become the rule of the land across the Atlantic world. So what happens in the United States is really part of a global movement where a regime of passports comes into being, where one had not really existed before.
May, the image of the wall that's being built along the Mexican border stands in stark contrast to the Statue of Liberty in New York and sends a kind of chilling message to us about what we stand for. I wonder how you feel about that. Is that a cheap shot?
You know, Ellis Island has always been seen as the front door to America, and the Mexican border is the back door.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But, you know, I don't know. I think we've always had different doors for different people. And the idea that Ellis Island is the front door privileges the whole European kind of origins and character of America, which is a one-sided story.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can only really subscribe to the front door, back door theory maybe if you think America really started in Plymouth Rock or you know.
May, we're living in a more cosmopolitan, globalized world than ever before, but we have this old problem of growing anxiety about borders, even as the population is getting more and more diverse. It seems a little bit, well, something of a contradiction, doesn't it?
Well, you know, as I was speaking of the 19th century, I think today as well, you have a diversity of opinion in the American population about immigration and immigrants. And even if you talk to a person, you might find that person having contradictory attitudes themselves. They may be against immigration as a political question, but they'll exclude from that the people that, you know, clean their house, right?
Right.
Maria is a really nice person, right, is what they'll tell you. But not Maria's neighbors, who they don't know. You know, the curious thing about, I think, most Americans is even those people who are leery about immigrants and immigration, nobody really wants to deport 12 million people.
Well, May, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
May Nye is a professor of history at Columbia University. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America.
So Peter and Ed, I mean, Professor Nye talks about the legislation we're familiar with, restrictivist legislation from the 1920s, but you guys know that nativism was an issue reaching all the way back to the early 19th century.
Oh, yeah. Hostility toward foreigners goes back to the 1790s and beyond.
I mean, you could argue in many ways that the whole settlement of the British of North America is a kind of nativism in terms of defining themselves against other kinds of peoples with different religions. And I'm thinking of the Spanish, yeah. So I'm thinking about.
So, including the people who were actually native here.
Right. Well, that's right. That would be anti-nativist nativism.
Right.
But what's interesting is the way that, and we heard it in the clips, no matter how much things change, what's wrong with immigrants? It's been the same thing that's wrong with them from day one, which is A, they're dirty. B, they're taking our jobs.
Yeah.
C, they're of a different religion. And D, they will never, ever learn to live by the high standards of civilization that we've acquired as natives. And so there's a kind of a strange lack of imagination or specificity
or historical knowledge.
And you know,
well,
what,
that's right.
What I find striking, Ed and Brian, is that this toxic talk about foreigners reminds us of eugenics and the heyday of that kind of ethno-nationalism that just seems out of tune with multicultural America. But somehow these things coexist. A public culture which embraces diversity and difference, and a commercial culture that embraces diversity, yet somehow we can still draw those lines and we can keep those dangerous foreigners out.
Yeah.
But we could almost take heart from the fact that a national nativist party has only existed really just for the merest flicker of time in the 1850s, right?
I know nothing about it.
That is terrible.
That is pretty pathetic.
Our friends in Radio Land, he's referring to the Know Nothing Party. Back to my serious point, that even though this is a recurring theme in American history, it's not really been able to be institutionalized or to be sustained as a central point of a political initiative for very long.
I mean, I think there are some pretty clear reasons. Number one, because we have lots of people here who are not far removed from being immigrants themselves. And secondly, business has always had a great stake in keeping our borders open.
Right.
And, you know, there are not many ideas that are considered fundamental to all American identity. But I do believe that sort of all people created equal, and we're a nation of immigrants are right there. This is Backstory, the show that looks back in time for answers about the issues facing us today. I'm Ed Ayers.
I'm Peter Onuf.
And I'm Brian Bello. We're talking today about how American attitudes towards its immigrants have changed over the course of our history. Some of you have already sent us your thoughts on the subject, and we've invited you to join us on the air. Peter, who's up first today?
We got Jim on the line from Devon, Pennsylvania. Jim, welcome to Backstory.
Thanks very much. I want to raise a question about a kind of myth that we often hear.
All right.
We get this common feeling that things were much easier for immigrants in those days. There wasn't any resistance. They fitted into the society very well, in contrast with the 20th century and maybe even today. Where they are believed not to fit into the society very well. I think the immigrants had a tougher time in those days. There were no restrictions into their coming, but then there were a lot of people that disliked them, the so-called nativists.
Sure. Sure.
And there was actual violence to try to discourage them and maybe discourage others from coming.
What you're saying, Jim, is that the actual enforcement of immigration, it was kind of enforced on the ground in the early 19th century when and where people actually arrived. And what has happened over the century is we've kind of formalized that and pushed the barriers out to the literal boundaries of the nation state. And so now we simply say, yeah, you're not allowed here.
Yeah, that's a great point you're making, Jim. It's a good opportunity to talk about some of the things that people feared about immigrants. Some of the things that come to mind are Catholic religion, in many cases, for the Irish particularly, a notion that peasants from Ireland, displaced by the famine and so forth, were semi-savage. They weren't really civilized.
Yeah, later on in the century, Jim, the political threat is that these people may be socialists and might lead strikes and be radicals.
That's right.
And often were.
Yeah, well, the idea that immigrants could be subversives promoting worldwide revolution, of course, is a 20th century theme, but it's also a theme from the 1790s in the period of the French Revolution.
Right. which, of course, was the background of the Alien Acts, as they were called then.
Yeah, well, that was part of the quasi-war with France in the late 1790s because the French were preying on American shipping, and the fear of international Jacobinism, that is, the spread of French revolutionary ideas. And the Alien Acts of 1798 had to do with the status both of friendly and enemy aliens. Now, obviously, enemy aliens are always a suspect population, but what was remarkable about these acts was they extended to friendly aliens, that is, people from countries with whom we were not at war. It gave the Adams administration tremendous license to police and control the population and to send aliens home, to get rid of them.
So how many aliens were sent back?
Well, you know, it was more a chilling thing. The chief effect of these acts, there was also the Sedition Act, was to throw opposition editors, Jeffersonian editors, into jail and to shut up the presses. Virtually every Republican paper in the country was shut down or threatened with being shut down. The result, of course, was almost predictable, that this led to a tremendous boost, a blowback, a reaction, so that the number of Republican editors just mushroomed.
Right.
In fact, there would have been no Jefferson victory in 1800 without these Federalist acts overreaching on behalf of national security, because the problem with the war with France is it never happened. Adams negotiated a peace, and that's why Alexander Hamilton hated him so much.
So this is a theme throughout our history then, isn't that people are always warning about the terrible things that are going to happen from immigration, and they never have.
Yeah, well, they don't.
You know, if there was a golden age at all in immigration, and maybe a group, I would think maybe the Jews who came here before the American Civil War from Germany seemed to find a place in the United States that other groups simply have not. Does that make any sense to you guys?
Well, for one thing, the identity of those Jews was more often seen as German than as Jews. They spoke German. They regarded themselves very often as part of the German community.
Uh-huh.
And that made it somewhat easier for them, as opposed to the East European Jews later in the century.
Oh, very much so. And another something surprising to people, I think, is the amount of acceptance those Jews found in the slave South, that they were really quite assimilated into white society and granted a lot of respect and even made Secretary of War in the Confederacy, Judah P. Benjamin. So it's, I guess, one way that race kind of trumped this other kind of identity.
But Jim makes a great point in saying, yeah, we let everyone come, but, you know, then we beat them over the head when they got here if they weren't the right kind of person.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We got another call, History Guys. It's Cecile from Apalachin, New York. Cecile.
Hi.
Welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. My question is, what do you think is the reason for exactly what you said on the website, the announcement for the show, the fear of people coming in, the fear of others? I think it boils down to eugenics. I mean, you can actually see it in the word alien, somebody who is not like us, who is genetically not like us.
Well, I think you're onto something. I think it's right in the middle of the story with eugenics, though. Wouldn't you agree, Ed?
Yeah, that's a really early 20th century concept.
Absolutely. So we're not denying it's a factor, but just to play devil's advocate, so to speak, let's talk about Catholics who are racially and ethnically not that different from many of the other people coming over. What is really different is their religion. And there was incredible discrimination.
Brian. But what all you've really done is made Cecile's point so powerfully, because in the 19th century, in cartoons and representations, they were portrayed not only as a different variety of human, but even subhuman, and they were portrayed as apes. So here you have a case which kids, students are very puzzled by this. Why would they portray the Irish this way? And it's the racialization or the geneticization, if I make up an ugly word, that is imagining a religious difference as a racial difference, as a genetic difference.
Yeah. Well, it goes back before the 19th century. It goes back to the English encounter with the Irish in Ireland in the 17th century, the conquest of Ireland. And that expression, beyond the Pale of Dublin,
yes.
It's the area beyond the English settlements. Beyond the Pale, you had the wild Irish, who were depicted often in those cartoons that or caricatures that's talking about as savages, as hairy beasts. And the notion of the wild Irish carried over to first encounters with Native Americans, who were seen as another kind of Irishman.
That's
so
fascinating.
I think this notion of racial thinking is really deep-seated. The kicker is that race is a very imprecise concept. And so it's only in the late 19th and 20th centuries that we can properly talk about eugenics. That is, that there's a biological genetic basis for all this.
So, guys, are you saying that what we're really talking about when we talk about alien is racial aliens? Is that what makes people alien?
I think that's a common theme, and Cecile's right to focus on it. But alien basically just means other or different. The word alienate, to sell, that is to separate. And I think there's a universal anxiety about separation and about difference. And political communities, as much as individuals, can get upset about these questions of purity and defining who they are.
Well, what I'm upset about is that listening to that makes me realize that Brian was right at the very outset of this call when he looked to Catholicism as a sort of non-racialized kind of alienation. And Peter, I believe that
you
would agree.
Man.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and
yeah.
Thank you, Cecile, for staying on the line.
but
yeah,
Peter,
would you
say that in the 16th, 17th centuries that would have been seen as the ultimately alienating fact among Europeans?
I think that's true. But what I'd also say is that religion has historically been seen as a birthright, something that comes out of tradition, out of family groups, and that is co-religionists, people who share the same faith, have some kind of deep bond, and it's often understood to be ethnic or racial. So I think we're all right.
Oh, I love that.
Cecile, thanks for hanging in. It's been fun talking
to you.
Thank
you so much, Cecile.
Calling.
Thanks for a great conversation.
Well, that kind of fundamental fear of difference that you were talking about, Peter, I mean, it's definitely a factor in how Americans have treated immigrants. But I don't think we should just dismiss the real bread and butter issues that have also motivated a lot of bad feelings. I mean, I think that there's some reasons that all of this grating and jarring takes place. Take the history of immigrants' relationships with African Americans. Both immigrants and African Americans often find themselves competing for jobs at the bottom of the wage scale. And as a result, Black leaders, going back to Frederick Douglass, often haven't been thrilled about the new immigration. I recently discussed some of this with a former political science professor named Frank Morris. He's a board member at the Center for Immigration Studies, which is a pro-restrictionist group, and he picked up the story where that historian earlier in the show, May Nye, left off. The 1920s, when the government began imposing all those restrictive quotas on immigrants from South and Eastern Europe, and there were suddenly a lot of jobs to be had in the industrial North.
And so you found African Americans began to move north, especially after a number of riots throughout the Midwest and the South after World War I. And they couldn't get into the unions, but immigrants could. So they were used as strike breakers. And this is one of the unstated things about America. America has always given immigrants a better deal in terms of labor market access than they have African Americans. African Americans have only been accepted in the labor market when all other sources are not available, whether that's caused by World War I or whether it's caused by World War II, when the war of mobilization required every bit of labor, or whether it's required in the 1990s, in the boom years there, even when you had high immigrant labor, but you found that blacks with criminal records coming out of prison were still being utilized. You had increase in black employment in the 90s. So the pattern is very simple. Whenever there's an additional labor supply available, that supply will be picked over African Americans.
Let me ask you specifically about African American leaders, people like Booker T. Washington or W.E.B. Du Bois. What was their position? on immigration.
Well, let me talk about one. Let's talk about Booker T. Washington, there's his famous 1895 Atlanta Exposition speech, when he said that, you know, the industrialists of the North should not turn toward immigrant labor when labor of the South, both black and white, can work the factories, etc.
So what happened to that black leadership, recognizing that, you know, it was an either-or situation, as you characterize it? Why did they stop defending African-Americans?
The Civil Rights Movement, which generated the change in the immigration law in 1965. The Civil Rights Movement, of course, is for equality and was used as a basis by Kennedy and others to, you know, eliminate the racist 24 laws in 65. So you have black folks identifying initially with immigrants. And from that day until this, many African-Americans mistakenly believe that immigrants are going to be very powerfully or pro-African-American. They think that there's going to be some grand political coalition, progressive coalition, without realizing that many times, many immigrants, when they come to this country, certainly don't identify with African-Americans. They see African-Americans as threats. But you aren't going to get the leaders to say this, because it seems that every politician, whether they're Irish, whether they're Catholic, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Italian, if they see enhancing their base and doing things for their base is proper, that's understood. But for African-American politicians, and they feel this, that if they do things for their base, they're seen as racist.
What you're saying is that African-Americans are not taking care of their own the way other communities of interests are. Is that a fair statement?
I'm saying the politicians, the African-American politicians. Polls show that African-Americans at the grassroots level are really concerned about immigration. And you hear it all the time. When we don't see African-Americans that are in the service industries, in hotels that we, you know, once had those jobs, when we travel and we notice the construction crews, et cetera, et cetera.
So, Professor Morris, if your conclusion from your study of history is that African Americans have only been given an equal shot at the job market when immigration restriction is cut off, are you an advocate of restricting immigration today?
The United States is the only industrial country where immigration is in the Homeland Security, or it used to be the Department of Justice, instead of in the Labor Department. Every other industrial country determines their immigration by their labor requirements. We sort of refuse to do this. And this greatly impacts upon not only African-American workers, but all other workers, not only low-wage workers, but so-called high-tech workers now. That's what's so ironic here, that natural coalitions that should have been forming between white and black and brown Americans going all the way back to the 1880s hasn't formed because of the distortions of race. So the answer is yes. What we really need to do is to give a priority, especially in times of increased globalization, in times of increased outsourcing, toward a priority for American workers.
Well, Professor Morris, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for asking me.
Frank Morris is a board member at the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank in Washington, D.C., that favors tougher immigration restrictions. He's the former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation.
Well, that was some strong stuff, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It strikes me empirically, he is absolutely correct that the only time that African Americans had a shot in the industrial North is when immigration slowed or dried up and there was a desperate need for labor.
Yeah. And when you hear the overheated rhetoric of people like Lou Dobbs, it's easy for us to poo-poo this restrictionist sentiment. But there are significant segments of the population that really do face the increased competition and some of the uncomfortable downsides of completely open immigration.
But let's look at it from the viewpoint of the immigrants who are doing these jobs that Professor Morris was talking about. You know, that you can't drive by a construction site and not be struck by the prevalence of Hispanic men who are working there. Now, how does that happen? Is that just because they're willing to work for less? Or is that because there's a kind of the same ethnic mobilization that led the Chinese on the railroads or the Irish in the police forces or the, you know, Southern Europeans in the steel mills? There seems to be a kind of a networking among these immigrant groups that it's not just the individual working of the market that, you know, the employer's looking, oh, do I take a black worker or a brown worker? But rather, that brown workers are showing up with, you know, cousins who've just immigrated and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's not an accident that these people are filling these jobs.
But it sounds terrible, but immigrants are willing to do things that native populations are not. They will work for less, and it's partly relative to labor markets in countries of origins. That is, they come from places where what they're making in America, in the U.S., and remitting back home is tremendous advantage for them. This asymmetry of labor markets, I think, is the crucial thing.
And so these immigrants are coming in a rational economic decision they are making is working for less than a native American
absolutely.
Would do. But it also makes sense for somebody who is, you know, fifth or sixth generation African American to refuse to take a job at that level.
Yeah, it seems almost like some sort of demeaning peonage.
So what it means is everybody is acting rationally in all this. Mm-hmm. Employers are saying, well, why should I pay more
right.
if I can get these hardworking people for this amount?
I think that's a great point. And everybody's acting rationally.
Quick break. When we get back, we'll talk about efforts to keep immigrants out with a person whose job it is to keep them in.